Welcome to Speak Freely. Your host for today is Jim Fishwick. Jim is an award-winning theatre maker and experience designer who specializes in improvised, interactive, and immersive performance.
Kia ora koutou, everyone. Welcome to Speak Freely. This is the second in our series of conversations, of panels, of chit-chats, of asking questions, and sometimes even answering them when we get to it. Speak Freely is presented by Impro Melbourne, and Impro Melbourne is based on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. And we pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and through them to all First Nations people of Australia. And sovereignty was never ceded. I personally am in Kirikiriroa in Aotearoa, New Zealand, where Waikato Tainui are tangata whenua. Tihe moriora e ngā mana e ngā reo e rau rangatira mā, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa. We have some guests coming in this Speak Freely. As you know, each episode, each edition, each time, we visit different areas of the world. And today we are visiting Asia. We've got some guests from Taiwan, some guests from Japan, and we've got guests from India. And we want to acknowledge that within India, we want to acknowledge the cultures, labor, and dignity of the many productive castes and other cultures who have been systematically peripheralized in India for being leaders of voices of criticality and original language of performance and dissent. It's important to get that marked up front. Thank you all so much for joining us. The way today is going to work, we will have a big old talk. The first couple of questions will come from me and my co-host, who I'll introduce in a second. But along the way, you can also ask questions yourself. At the bottom of your screen, you will see a button which is marked Q&A, and that's where you can ask your Qs. You can put your questions in there, and then later on, we will give you some A's by answering them. So if there's a burning question that you have right now, you can submit that in the Q&A box, or if something comes up later on, you're like, oh, I want people to talk more about that, then please ask us a question. We will get it asked for you. All righty, it's time to get to our first guest, my co-host on this adventure through the world. Will you please welcome the former artistic director of Clockfight Theatre, of the Dynasty Soapathon, of Impro Melbourne, and the author of Improvise Freely, Paddy Styles.
Hey, Jim.
Hello, Paddy. How are you?
I am great. How are you?
I am very well. I am very well indeed. Lovely to see you.
And you.
It's been, I think, a month since our first Speak Freely. This whole series of events is marking the launch of your book, Improvise Freely. Would you like to say a few words about that?
Yeah. So Improvise Freely is basically questioning the rules around improvisation. There's a theory that creativity can be taught with rules, and using rules in a very strong sense of a right and wrong and must always do, which I argue in my book doesn't help creativity. It actually limits creativity. When we start putting creativity into a always this, never that, it immediately reduces options and possibilities. And I think that's dangerous to just accept without a question, without a discussion, without looking at it to see if it serves what you're creating. Maybe it does, but question it, look at it, discuss it, decide that for yourself, which is one of the reasons I'm really excited by today's panel. Everybody on the panel today has been working in improvisation, in mainstream improvisation, but also have had projects that are outside the mainstream. They've got a background and a body of work that adds to the beautiful variety and diversity of what improvisation actually is. And some people would say what improvisation can be, It already is. It's just mainstream improvisation tends to only see improv as improv, comedic, and games. Improvisation is a form, and there's a lot we can do with it.
That's so true. That's so exciting. I think we should get into it. All right, it's time to introduce our panel. Our first guest is Anshu Dagar, who is a creative entrepreneur and performing arts enthusiast. With a background as a creative and strategic communications specialist, she founded The Inner Startup, who deliver a whole range of exciting experiential workshops. As an improviser, she trained with Forum Theatre in London and currently coaches and performs with Nautanki Bar's Improv Collective, the coolest improv group in Northern India. She also runs a playback theatre company and is the artistic director of Roots and Wings Theatre Company. Will you please welcome Anshu Dagar?
Thank you so much. Hello, everyone. So excited to be here.
Lovely to see you, Anshu. Our next guest from Japan is Carly Gray. Carly is a musician, actor, composer, and educator with a fascination for improvisation. As a jazz musician, she specializes in the rare contrabass clarinet, but also dabbles in other reed instruments along the way. Since 2007, she's also performed improvised theater and taught with the Tokyo Comedy Store, and recently started her own Music for Humans workshop series and YouTube channel, which develops improvised music making skills for beginner and experienced musicians alike. Please welcome Carly Gray.
Lovely to be here. Hi.
Hello. Next guest from India as well is Lakshmi Priya. Lakshmi is a playback theatre performer and has been improvising for a decade in and around Bangalore in India. She performs with the Adamant Eves, incredible name, India's first all-female improv company, and is a co-founder of City Lamps Playback Theatre. A graduate of Interdisciplinary Humanities from the Manipal Center for Philosophy and Humanities, and since 2014, she's facilitated spontaneous theater-based training to encourage play and creativity in workplaces and learning environments. Please welcome Lakshmi Priya.
Hi, so excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
An absolute pleasure. And our last guest from Taiwan is Wu Xiaoxian. Xiaoxian is the founder and artistic director of Guts Improv Theatre, the first improv theatre in Taiwan. She studied at BATS in San Francisco and teaches improv in the Department of Filmmaking at the Taipei National University of Arts. She is the translator into traditional Chinese Mandarin of Improv Wisdom by Patricia Ryan Madsen and the reviser of Impro by Keith Johnston. She also hosts the Mandarin speaking podcast Improvism. Please welcome Wu Xiaoxian. Have we got everyone? Everyone's. I was looking at it wrong. Hello, good to see you.
Hi.
To kick us off today, Patty has prepared a question that
yes.
I'd like to ask. Patty, over to you.
I have. Thank you all for being here, everyone. Thank you. So in doing some reading and some research on all of you, it was really fascinating to discover that you all had a performing arts background before you came to mainstream improvisation. So I'm going to ask you a little bit about some projects that you've been working on, and then I'm going to ask a question at the end. Okay? So first, I'd like to ask Lakshmi if you could tell us a little bit about the Social Improv Justice Project that you've been involved in.
Yeah, it's with Shari and Rachel. It's with a grant from New York City. It's about looking at the possibility of satire as restructuring the larger patriarchal construct and using improvisation as a tool to create satire. And it's sort of my first space of solidifying something from improv. I usually do improv and then that's that in its ephemeral nature. So it's really exciting to be in a space where, you know, then that can be used to change the way we think and tell narratives. So yeah, that's the video team, they also have an ensemble team. So it's a larger project, which is very exciting.
Wonderful, thank you. Anshu, there's a project that you've been working on that's called #AndMe. Could you tell us a little bit about that, please?
So #AndMe is about a woman's journey. It's about what defines women and why is it that she has to take a permission all through her life. This is actually a forum theater play. And the way forum theater works is we take out real stories from real lives of people, create a scripted play, and then the last element is the improvisation part, where audiences come are invited to come up on stage and make changes to the play and take on any character. And AndMe was actually my first play with my group Roots and Wings Theatre, and it's still as fresh as it was, so nothing is outdated there. The challenges still remain, but it's beautiful to see how people actually make interventions and come up with great solutions there.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you. Thank you. Kali, when I was reading your website, which is just a beautiful website, I was really drawn to the Mantra Jam. Would you mind telling us about that?
Sure. So I've always had an interest in Eastern spirituality. I grew up in Hong Kong, so maybe that's part of it. But one of my favorite jazz musicians, a guy called Steve Lacy, is someone who worked a lot with setting poems and words to music. And I've had a hard time getting together groups to play this music, his music, in a dedicated way. But what I wanted to do is I figured that by using shorter, kind of pithy kind of things, we might actually be able to improvise music around these mantras. So the idea is it would be kind of like spiritually intentioned perhaps, but also a relaxing thing, but with the potential basically to take people on a personal journey through the words that we're using.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Sure, my pleasure.
Thank you. And Wu Xiaoxian, you have a workshop that's called Improv Games That Wake Your Civic Consciousness. Could you tell us about that, please?
Yeah, actually it's not me to lead that workshop, but I designed the workshop with one of the member in my group, Huai Yu. And it's because in 2019, when we are about to have
is anybody else frozen?
Yeah, Xiaoxian is frozen for me as well. We might have to come back to her.
Okay.
Answer that.
Yes. So when she joins back on, we'll pause to let her explain about the workshop, and then we can re-ask this question. So what inspired me was reading this beautiful diversity of work. Yeah, civic consciousness, spirituality, mantras, social consciousness, social constructs, looking at the feminism perspective. That is not mainstream improvisation as most people know it, and as it is often taught. So I'd like to know what motivates you, what drives you to explore improvisation this way, to speak this voice, to challenge these subjects? Is anybody? Yeah, Kelly.
I would say that what I've found to be the case is that improvisation is kind of the universal language within art. I mean, you can improvise in any genre of art, but also even cross the board in education and education, spirituality, and I mean, even just in basic daily human life, improvisation is there. So I'm just fascinated by it as just a real fundament of human experience, but one that has kind of been very much suppressed and ignored, at least consciously. So that's kind of what guides me to follow these different paths. It's really just wanting to figure out what's actually going on behind all of this organization and planning and stuff that we grow up with, you know?
Great.
Yeah, so I think for me, you know, the fact that improvisation is not just spontaneous, but it actually breaks the fourth wall. And adding that bit to all the work that I do, I feel that makes it really real. You can't really have a pretense there. And also what happens is when you your conversations are real, when you get the real feedback from people, I think transformations are more overlasting. And there is a shift in the mindset as well, which it brings with it. So I feel improv along with spontaneity and the realism that it brings in together makes it a great combination to spread messages or raise any issue that you wish to.
Great.
Just to add to all the wonderful things we heard from Kali and Anshu already, I think the kind of art that excites me and interests me and engages me I've been able to be more cognizant of that. I think over 2020 and 2021, frankly, I junked out on improv in 2020 because the access was huge with online improv. So I was waking up at like 3 o'clock, I was sleeping at like 12 and midnight, past midnight. And suddenly in 2021, it was like, okay, if this situation, global crisis is going to be longer, you have coped for a year. Now you need to think about what you really want to put your energy in. And that's when I was like, what is the sort of improv that's exciting me? And I'm much like, I think many of us, and mostly a lot of us who do improv, I do think art is political. Like there is no way to separate these two. Like existence is political, existence is performance, therefore improv is political. And who I am informs, even if I was not to put it in a framework and say, hey, this is social justice improv, or hey, this is, you know, I am coming from as an upper caste, urban educated Indian who's under 30, which means I'm seen as a very productive age in a country which is sort of a younger democracy, where I get a lot of opportunity, which most 80% of or 98% of the country doesn't get. I'm already, the very fact that I'm doing improvisation is really political. So this is the kind of improv that excites me in a way that it's truthful to my experience. And I probably that's why.
Great. Now, the follow-up question on this, do you think that as improvisers, as artists, and as humans, we have a responsibility to use our platform to engage in such subjects? Over to the panel.
Yes. I will nearly always dive in first unless someone does, but Lakshmi, please go for it.
I think responsibility is like interesting. And I think the construction of responsibility is always in a binary to play, usually. You know, like there's play and then like you're responsible, and somehow shoulder looks like this when you're responsible. When you're playing, the shoulders look like this. But I think in improv, there's an actually unique chance to mix them, like play responsibly in a way that we don't have to go, the construct doesn't have to be rigid. So for me, even if we were not consciously talking about frameworks in which we spoke about our works, we're still doing the kind of work which needs to be responsible. We are, and also, I mean, every minute that we are on stage with improv, we are pretty much naked in that sense of our biases, of our preconceived notions. So anyway, when at least I like to think of it as a moment I see myself along with my co-players. So that's already a moment of vulnerability. And I don't know if I would say responsibility, but I would say learning is constant in improv, because it's always a mirror. And I'm like, why did I make that choice? Why would I say that? Why did I think that was the thing that comes after X, Y, or Z? So yeah, responsibility is interesting, but I think it's more a mirroring process.
Great.
So there's this saying we all know about, with great power comes great responsibility. But I think that's a lot of pressure there. And I would agree with Lakshmi that responsibility would be a tough word. But as improvisers, I think we do have I could call it powers, some powers there where we can make a shift. We can make people think. We can make people move. Should we take it as a responsibility and put pressure on ourselves, or try and adapt or do something which may not lead to what we wish to, because it's all spontaneous and it's not really something which can really be in our hands and can be controlled by us? I would say, first responsibility or the power should be on us, on how we make ourselves better, how we change ourselves, become better human beings and see the change and vulnerability within ourselves. Then we look at outside towards the society on making those little shifts, which may not be the great change makers, but at least even if those are little shifts we can do through improvisation, I think why not? We can, and we could look at doing it without the pressures of it. Yeah.
Wonderful. So Wu Shashen, we'll have Kali finish answering this question, and then we'll have you continue explaining the sip of consciousness. And I'm so glad you're back. Yeah, so Kali, do you have anything to say on the responsibility?
Yes. When you say responsibility, I'm assuming that you mean social responsibility. So I do think that it's a double-edged kind of thing where it's like, you know, there's that saying, Alan Moore, the comic book writer, who said that it's the job of the artist to give the audience not what they want, but what they need. And I am on board with that very much. But I do also think it's really careful to remember your responsibility to yourself as well. In other words, what am I capable of giving at this time? For me, often going on stage, especially as someone who presents in a generally gender non-conforming way, it's kind of a political statement or a social justice statement, perhaps even, to just get on stage sometimes. And one of the things that I've been thinking about a fair bit over this pandemic period is how much I've been putting that on myself without necessarily being aware of what the consequences might be. So I do think it is a case of balancing one's responsibility to oneself as well as to an audience or to one's art form. So great question there.
And great answers. Thank you all. So Wu Shashen, if we can have you tell us about that workshop, and then maybe we'll bounce to Jim's next question, if you don't mind. Oh, you're on mute.
Okay, I'm back. Sorry, just that good timing. My internet just disconnect. Maybe there's a big brother watching us or something about what I'm about to say. Okay. So I'm not sure what you just heard about my talking, like when is the timing that my internet dead. So I just restart to answer your question. Okay. So about that workshop, it's what we want waking up the civic consciousness using improv game. Why?
No. No.
I think it's a conspiracy.
It's got to be Big Brother, because she said both times civic consciousness, yeah. And then there was a freeze.
Oh no. That's truly okay. Remarkable and unfortunate.
If we yes. Absolutely, Joe. Yes, free Taiwan. Yes. If we lose her again, then when she comes back, let's ask a different question. So that we don't lose her the next time. Maybe we should move on to the next question.
Sure.
Yeah.
I hope that we're able to get her back. So because I am now very keen to hear about this workshop.
Let's ask right at the end.
Yes. Yeah. Or we'll ask, please don't tell us about this workshop. So I have a question that sort of relates to what we were just talking about, but it comes out of a practical issue, which is I'm working on a show at the moment that I'm going to present soon. And one of the things that I've been thinking about is at the start of the show, my instinct is that I, as the director or as the host, should tell the audience a little bit about what the show is, tell them how it works, or give them some sort of information on how the show is going to work. But I was thinking about it, is that if you go see a scripted play, they very rarely do that. No one says, hey everyone, welcome to our scripted show. What's going to happen is these actors have learned their lines and they're going to come out and they're going to try and remember their lines. Ooh. So I can see both sides of this, which is to some extent, we want to explain to, we want our audience to be on board with what's happening, because sometimes improvisation is unfamiliar to them, or sometimes we're doing something that's in a different form of improvisation than they might be used to. But then also I feel like the art should stand on its own to some extent. Like we should trust the intelligence of the audience to be able to follow what's happening. And so I was wondering, what's your opinion? Do you think we should tell the audience what's about to happen up front, or should we trust their intelligence to come with them? I honestly have no idea what the right answer to this is, so I would love to hear your thoughts, because it will help me put my show on.
So for me, I think this is a dilemma even I have had constantly with my shows and the workshops as well that I do, whether the participants should know what's the takeaway, or whether they should know what are the nuances of the game or exercise they're doing, or whether the audience should know what's involved and what is their role in this performance that or the show that we're going to show them. I've seen both sides and I've tried both sides where I don't tell them. What happens when I don't tell them is there are some who kind of understand and figure it out and are invested in it. But then there are those who are lost because they're not sure what is it that we wish to achieve or what is it that they need to give to it. So to get a balance, what I feel is would be good is to actually take a mid path where we give a kind of a brief, because you know it's not the usual play. Largely, I would say 100% of the audience would have seen a scripted play. So that's one of the reasons why we don't need an introduction there. But improvisatory theater or anything to do which is out of the ordinary or the usual theater, it's good to give a slight brief, leave some elements for surprise, some elements for shock, some elements for them to wonder as well. But slight introduction, slight brief on, you know, which are the moments maybe you might want them to look up, or maybe you will want them to come in into, and then rest, we can leave it freeze the way I usually now go with my work.
Thank you so much. Anybody else have any thoughts?
Anybody else got any help for you on your show, Yumi?
Please.
I personally, when I've done more experimental performances, and you know, the audience has come along to take part in essentially my experiment, I do like to try and lead them along as cleanly as I can, as friction free. But I really do think it depends on the effect that you want to leave them with. I mean, humans are generally, you know, we like familiarity and we shy away from, I'm talking very generally here. I mean, I know this is a room full of improvisers, but we like familiarity and we shy away from danger or difference. And I think that if you're willing, if you think that you have, if you think that your audience can handle the danger of you just diving in, you know, like it's an effect in the end, isn't it? You know, it's like, what do you want to leave them with? Yeah, that's probably the way I would go. I would approach it anyway.
I can go next. I think there are perhaps like two things. One thing that it curiously reminded me of something that I read recently, which I'll share later. But for me, the question is about expectation setting, and it's very culturally located for me. For somebody who's in India where improv is really new, it means that there needs to be some level of sharing, because already when somebody ends up at improv, it's like, I thought this was going to be stand-up. And I'm like, no, it's not going to be stand-up. Or they're like, I thought it was going to be like scripted. And they're like, no, it's... So there's a certain level of expectation setting so that the community grows, because of the stage in which the art form is at the moment. And that's something that I also, and as a team, we have to do for playback theater, because it's a theater of real life stories. And there's this particular ritual. And for me, this is the important part of helping the audience arrive from whatever life they were leading the minute they step into that moment, be it Zoom room. So there's that ritual of arriving into that moment of performance. And I think what I would ask is, what does this show need? Does this show need them to somehow keep, and we are never going to be 100%. They're never going to leave their like life behind, because we are also wanting to provoke them. We're also wanting to challenge them. We're also wanting to make them curious, which means they can't be all these things without their histories. But at that moment, do we want them to be here, and what sort of ritual helps them? Do we want to shock them into that? Then maybe we don't want to share anything. Or do we want them to be relaxed and not be worried about, oh, what's going to happen? Then some information would rid them of that anxiety and be present. And the second quickly thing that it reminded me of, there's a new study on trigger warnings. And the unanimous conclusions, scientifically, psychologically, some of it is bringing up, is that trigger warnings are not effective, because it actually makes people more anxious. And this is by students who have had post-traumatic stress disorder. And this is basically academicians or teachers having conversation about, you know, because it became a big feminist lexicon to have trigger warnings. But now they're talking about whom is it really serving, and does it have a role beyond symbolic, you know, posturing. So I think that's a good question for us to ask about our work also, beyond the symbolic posturing. What is the ritual of expectation setting for going to do for this particular show? So I think that's how I would subjectively answer.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Welcome back, Xiaoxian. We might not invoke the wrath of the internet again by getting you to answer the same question. But at the moment, we're talking about, at the start of a show, how much do you tell the audience about what's going to happen? Do you need to tell them how the format is going to work, or do you let them discover it for themselves? So I've had some answers there. I might go to Patty first, so you get a second think about it. Patty, do you have anything you wanted to add?
Yeah, very much along the same lines as everybody else. What do you want the audience to experience, and what do they need at the beginning so that they can experience that? There's a difference between an audience being in a place of wonder and curiosity and information arriving to them, and they have to use their intellect a little, to them being completely out at sea and not knowing what's going on. And we don't want the audience to be lost where they're just simply trying to figure us out. That said, there are works that is the aim. So I'm talking for myself. But I don't mind the audience having to invest in the show. And so I might give smaller pieces at the beginning for some shows, larger pieces for other shows, but it depends on what I want them to experience. The other thing I would add in is that you can provide information in other ways outside of verbal. So how your seats are arranged, how people are greeted at the door, the music that's playing when they walk in, the lighting state that's in the venue and on stage, what is on stage, if it's a blank stage with black curtains, or it's a blank stage with a brick wall, those are different visuals and they communicate different sets of information. If it's, you know, a spotlight, if it's disco lights, all of this starts creating moods and impressions and feelings. You know, if you're playing, and I'm thinking, Kelly, of some of your inspirations, you know, if you're playing Glenn Miller, if you're playing Coltrane, if you're playing hip hop, that's going to trigger the audience differently when they walk into a space, because it just has a different context and feel. If you don't ask yourself the question, what would I like the audience to experience? That's going to be the difficulty in creating the beginning. There was actually a fellow on Twitter today, and I've forgotten his name, Joe something. And he's talking about writing musicals. And he said, a writing tip for writing a musical is don't write your opening number first. Write the musical, then write your opening number, because you don't know what needs to be communicated in the opening number until you know what the play is about. So I think that's kind of leads in.
Absolutely. Just to tie some of these different threads together, I'll post in the chat in a second. I recently wrote an article about creating immersive and interactive theater. And one of the principles that I use in creating immersive or interactive theater is the idea of a funnel that, like we said before, that people come from all sorts of days and we want to sort of gradually focus them towards the experience that we want them to have. And that's a physical thing, it's an emotional thing. But something that I picked up from a LARP designer was like a live action role play designer, is that a show begins the first time you hear about it, and it ends the last time you think about it. Like, that's the full length of a show. And so we're trying to design that whole, like, that's the whole show to try and consider. So it's your marketing, it's the foyer, it's do you send people an email after the show with some questions, like how do you invite them to do something off the back of the show? There's lots of different options. I'll post a link to that article with a bit of cheeky self-promotion in the chat in a second. Xiaoxian,
hi.
Welcome. Talking to the audience.
Can you hear me? Good.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm talking to the audience at the start of a show. What's your philosophy?
Okay. First of all, I changed to my iPhone to connect to this room. I give up my laptop. Okay. I agree many things that Patty just said. For us, like audience warm up, it's a big part of the show. We design each show differently to do the audience warm up. Sometimes we warm up them a lot. Sometimes we just start the show with music, with some things that act by the improvisers. And also, when we're running a show, we have that experience that at the beginning of the run, we designed the audience warm up in one way, but after a few shows, we think that that's not enough. We might need more warm up for this show for them to enjoy the rest of the show. And sometimes we think that's too much. We don't need that much warm up. we can start the improvising part quicker. So it's all different. Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you very much. Well, yeah. We are going to go now to our questions from the audience. We've got some great questions coming in. Don't forget that you can submit yours in the Q&A box down the bottom. And our first question, who should I pick? I'm going to go to Kevin Yank, who has a question here. Thank you for your question, Kevin. Kevin asks, to what extent is impro perceived as a Western art form by your audience? And do you do anything as artists to influence that perception one way or another? Any takers on that very small question from Kevin Yank?
I think for us, we don't emphasize where this art form comes from for our show. But for the workshop, we do sometimes mention that this art form is coming from Western and about what.
On civic disobedience and Western. Oh, there she's back. Good.
Oh, she's back. Off you.
Yeah. So we wanted to respect, like, learn these things from, and for this students to, if they want to know more about this, they can look for their research.
Right.
I think in my side of the country, and maybe my entire country, improv is at a very nascent stage here. So for us to make an introduction to improv, whether it's for a show or a workshop, you know, people just using the word improv does not really work, because it sounds interesting, but they don't really know what it means or what it entails. So whose line is it is like a reference point for people. So that's often used, in fact, to make that connect, to make them understand what we're talking about. And largely, it seems most of the people have watched it. So that helps the cause. So that's where the Western bit really comes in. But once they're inside the show, we bring in so much of our Indian ingredients into it that it's totally, I would say, especially my group is largely Indianized. We use a mix of Hindi and English, our language plus English mixed. We use a lot of references to our film culture from Bollywood, or is it from the regional cultures, regional language, or slangs, or, you know, things which are very local as well. So that's where we Indianize the entire thing. So it's only till they don't know, and the introduction is where the Western part stays. And once we are in, it becomes Indian for us.
I think I'll go next just to compliment what Anshu shared. It's interesting. I mean, first of all, it's a great privilege to be two Indians on the same panel, because I know we are doing global impro stuff, and I think it speaks to some of the multi-realities of a country which is just so, has just so many cultures every like 100 kilometers, you know, like so many cultures. So interestingly, and Nautanki Bars, which is Anshu's theater, does a lot of wonderful vernacular stuff. And I think it has a lot to do with the space that geographically and culturally that northern parts that work with. For example, Improv Comedy Bangalore, where I am from, we do a lot of American sitcom references, and our language is, I mean, sometimes we do try to do South Indian, which is in South India. So our reference language is vernacularly, but usually because of the demographical truth, we end up doing a lot more Western references. You know, we don't do as much Hindi because there's also a linguistic politics in the country. And I will not speak more about it. You should find out about language domination and linguistic politics in India if you're interested. But what I wanted to say was improvisation, and we were talking about this, improvisation and as in the mainstream is one thing, you know, as borrowed from the West. But then there is the idea of just so many native art forms which have improvisational part in it, like improvisation as a tool in it, like from the top of the country to the bottom, from east to west, all parts, there are such indigenous art forms which have their own ways of improvising. So is improvisation as a tool new to India? No, it's as old as song, as they say, the first song. Is improvisation as we do it, as again urban 20, 30 somethings do by reading, like say a book written by a Western, you know, improviser, is that new? Yes, because it's codified differently. And a lot of us, at least in my company, are not trained in any classical form. Not all of us, some of us are, but I am not, for example, and I can speak to this. And when I come in, this is my performance history, right? I have a performance history of two Western art forms, and that really is different from somebody who maybe has done Kudiyattam or Kuchipudi or Bharatnatyam, because they have experienced improvisation in their art form, which is native to this country, you know? And it's also, I think I'll end with also contextualizing it in a conversation that's going on in India, which is in caste politics. A lot of productive castes, which are castes which were oppressed for the longest time, talk about their indigenous art forms, which are also art forms of dissent and representation. And I am caste privileged, like I'm from the oppressor caste. And what happens is we co-opt and appropriate a lot of the art forms, and then we get bored because it's not ours. We have nothing original. So we reach out to the West to find something new. Also because we are the ones with money and access to speak English and know what improvisation means and cut means and end scene means. So there's a lot of wealth of improvisational forms, native improvisational forms, we don't even know about actually because of our social positioning. So that's also another truth just to bring in. But yeah, everybody asks, is this stand up all the time?
Thank you. Carly, do you have any thoughts on this?
Yes. Yeah. I think my main thought is that I don't really feel qualified to comment on how things are for Japanese people here, how they see improv. I'm not involved in that scene in Japanese. I've done some work with Japanese improvisers there was definitely a strong awareness of the origins of improv. But I do think it's one thing that I can say is that Japan is a country that traditionally takes things from other countries. You know, it's the Chinese alphabet that was adapted here. I mean, it's the Western digital technology that they've really taken on board. And there are Japanese people like Jun Imai, workshops, who is very much involved in bringing these teachings to Japanese people. And I do believe that he has very much his own way of doing it.
Thank you very much. Patty, do you have any thoughts?
It's not a question for me. I'm a Western person from a Western culture with a Western background and a Western teacher. Not my question. Thank you, but not my question.
I might move on to our next question then. There's some very sassy depictions of people's understandings of improv happening in the chat, predominantly from Joe Bill. So I'm going to put Joe Bill's question to you all. Joe asks, is art the goal of your improvisation, or is art a consequence of your improvising, or is it something that happens? Is it something that happens because you improvise, or is it something that you're trying to do when you improvise, or is it some combination of all of these? Again,
I'll take Joe up on that. Oh,
please go for it.
I was going to say I'll take Joe up on that. So I'm really into like theories of aesthetics, things like that. So I really like this question. Thank you, Joe. So basically, I think that this idea of art versus entertainment is kind of a false dichotomy. I personally don't really think it's like, I think that the bigger responsibility that we have is to produce something that is personal to us. And if that is perceived by an audience as art or artistic, that's more to do with the audience and the way that they're thinking about what we're doing. So there's that kind of like art versus entertainment dichotomy. But I really do think that what we're talking about, whether it's art or entertainment, is essentially affecting someone's state of consciousness. So what I aim to do when I make a performance, whether it's music or improv theater, is I aim to create a particular mood for the audience, or I have a particular place that I want to take them inside themselves. And of course, you know, it depends on them as well, again. But rather than thinking about it as, am I making art or not? Personally, I prefer to think about it as, what, like, am I having an effect on them? What effect am I having on them? What am I bringing into the mental space that we're all sharing? So I don't know if that's an answer or an evasion, but that's what I'm saying.
Thank you. Is anyone else? Lakshmi, yeah.
Yeah, I'll just quickly think about it, just because I'm so inspired by what Kali said. I think it's interesting that even in the question, Joe put it in quotes, the idea of art, which speaks directly to the history of the dichotomy that Kali was talking about, right? Especially in improv. And I'm not very well read in the origin of improv, but it does have a very rooted history in like social realities from Wyler's Follins, right? Like the fact that it was a response to a need, you know, and even with offers, at least it feels like we're responding to a need on stage because we don't have script. So the need didn't happen in the playwright's mind, but it happened on stage when I'm with my co-improviser and I see that they're walking towards a chair and I'm like, okay, there's a need to acknowledge their walk to the thing. So art as meaning and art as curiosity and art as not gatekeeping are the places where I think improv intersects. And it is art. I have felt like, and also this is an evasive answer because it took me a long time to say I'm an improviser rather than saying I improvise because of all the imposter realities. But now that I'm a bit more comfortable, the most meaningful I've felt is when an audience comes after a show and says, not that the show was excellent, brilliant, but like, hey, that thing that you said, I have said that, you know, and it was like you were in my head. And I'm like, yeah, there was some moment of truth there. And that's art for me. That's meaningful for me. And then it goes from like art with capital A and quotes to like ART, like a humble, truthful, curious reality.
That's so true. Thank you so much. Anybody else on the panel? Anshu, yeah.
I think I completely agree with the way Kali expressed it and Lakshmi has expressed. So I won't reiterate what they've already said because I am on the same lines and I believe the same. I would also add to that, and which is a little tangential from art, improv for me is, as a goal, it's not just the art, it's about the connection that it brings in. So there's a lot more to improv. It's the connection within myself. It's the connection with the audience, and it's the connection that the audience sees with me. So whether we would call it art, or whether we would call it reality, or we would call it something on a different plane, but improv is a lot about that as well for me. It's also a lot about spreading that connection and spreading happiness, and not just restricting it to thinking that it's just an art. Yeah.
Xiaxian or Patty?
Okay. I love this question very much as well, and I have so many thoughts, but I'll just start with this one thing I think about. It's art, the goal. I think it is at the beginning stage for me when I start to do, when I start to run my improv troupe. And we wanted to make that art good. We want to have a good skill to make a good art that can let the audience to willing to coming and then know about this art and appreciate its beauty. That's at the maybe the first 10 year or so when I doing improv in Taiwan. And I think after that, we have more ambition, not just to make a good art. We want to besides make people laugh or telling good story, we discovered improv also have good influence to us personally as improv creators. So we want this, they can experience that. And also I feel lucky, like for us to do improvisational theater. I think compared to scripted theater, when we do an improv, whether the show is good or not so good for a day, I think audience can get good things from a improvised show. Whether the story is good or not. That, I think that's, we are lucky. It's the amazing thing about improv, because I think audience will feel different when they watch scripted theater. I think that's what I feel, that we are lucky because we choose to do improv as a professional. So we just by doing a show, just to go onto the stage and take risk, this action, this process can influence people, can because audience, they come up to us after the show, probably a lot of time they just tell us that what they see during the show is not about the story, but what we do, what's our reaction as an individual improviser or as a group that inspired them, that make them feel profound to during the process of watching the show. So yeah, that's my answer.
Awesome. Thank you so much. For me personally, art isn't a goal of what I do, because I think that's like saying a runner saying that the goal of what they do is running. Like the art is the process with or the framework within which I do everything else. The goal obviously is making money. That's why I started improvising. So to throw your question back at you, Joe, it depends on what you mean by art, because like art is in the eye of the beholder. Like if you look at the fountain, the sculpture of a urinal ostensibly by Marcel Duchamp, like it's a urinal, but it's called art, so it's art. So like I could do the hackiest, like pew pew, pun pun, gag gag, improv-y, bar-prov, imaginable, it's still art. It's still a form of art. I personally happen to try and make art that is going to be seen as art. Like I want people to go like, oh, that was very artistic. Like I want to like meet everyone's art threshold, but that's separate to whether I am making art or not. I'll finish with, I was listening to an interview with Yo-Yo Ma, the cellist, who says that he tries to approach his life that he is a human first, a musician second, and a cellist third. That art may be in there, but it's negotiated within other hierarchies of being a human and being like a technician on a particular instrument. So take that, Joe. Great. No, it was Yo-Yo Ma on Desert Island Discs. I'm going to switch to two questions here that relate to Patty's book, Improvise Freely. So first question here is from Wendy King, who says, I'm still reading through Patty's book. I found the section on yes and really interesting. So for context, Patty's book looks at a couple of different rules of improvisation, one of them being yes and. Wendy says, particularly the dark side of yes and. Patty, I might get you to like quickly summarize what that section of the book is about. Actually, let's do that first, and then I'll come to the question at the end.
So yes and is a codified simplification of a skill, and that skill is acceptance. It's become a short form way of being able to say to people, here's what you do to accept. But that's not the only way to accept. And just because you do it doesn't mean that you do accept. So I have a look at that. But because it's been codified and then it's been turned into a rule and then it's been reinforced in a very feverish approach where, you know, people run around yelling at each other like it's some war cry, it has built up a culture around it where it is the thing you do not break. To the point of, you know, I was out having lunch with people and someone said, you know, would you like this? And I said, oh, no. And they went, well, that's not very yes and of you. I thought, well, it's lunch. It's lunch. I'm allowed to say no, right? But that system, that points out just how deep that rule has been ingrained to a level of obedience. And this is where the dark side kicks in. When you have people following obedience blindly, and I'm sorry, that's not a correct way of saying it. When you have people following obedience without questioning or thought or perception or choice, then that allows people to control, that allows people to manipulate. And this is what has happened. And I have had many experiences where I have held improvisers who have been in tears as they recall scenes that they've been in, where they have been put in situations that have been physically unsafe, that they have been sexualized and harassed, and their instincts are to say no. Their instincts are to push the offer away, but they have been conditioned into this form of obedience that they must yes and. They must say yes and. And in that moment, you have someone that has power and they have obedience and they have a culture that supports that obedience and they have this premise that this is the rule of improvising, and if you break this rule, you're not an improviser. So they have group mind, group influence, social power, individual power, obedience, dominance. And that is creating a very lethal cocktail in improvisation. We should be teaching acceptance. And within that, if someone has said something which is, you know, unkind, you can accept that it's unkind. And you can make the scene about an unkind thing. So that's the dark side, is this obedience culture.
Thank you, Patty. And for more of that, you can buy Improvise Freely at pattystyles.com. So the question at the end of that from Wendy King is, has anyone on the panel found this specific rule of yes and to be an issue in your creative communities? Or is yes and a dominant thing in improvisation where you are?
My mic is on. Okay. I have something that I observe from my past experience when I went to international festival or conferences about improv, that I think maybe it's because of the language. Yes and is like too English vocabulary, so that I discovered that in Taiwan we teach yes and as a concept. So this concept is really about acceptance and adding on. So we never encourage people to actually verbally say yes equal accept or equal what we need to do in when we improvise. But I do find out that more people who are native English speaker, sometimes they have this, maybe it's a confusion about they have to verbally say yes and something that is what they should do when they improvised. So that's one thing. So another thing is I always teach my student that the first thing about the concept of yes and, it's yes and yourself. So yes, so if someone, like you said, during the lunch, pick on you for saying no, that's a yes to you, not to order something that day. So yeah, so the first thing should be yes and yourself, and then you yes and other things. So that for me, it's two things that comes to my mind when talking about the negative side of the concept of yes and. Because I personally, I love this concept. What I feel is when people that think yes and it's not right, it's because they understand this concept wrong. So they think yes and is not always right in improvisation. But yeah, that's what I feel.
Fantastic, thank you so much. Lakshmi, do you have your...
Yeah, I just wanted to add like two things. As somebody who heard yes and maybe 4 years ago as a phrase, the first time I heard it, it was complimented. Jonathan Pitts was the one I was learning from, Improv Proper. And the first thing he said while he said yes and was, I prefer acceptance and building. So as a student, in my head, yes and was just a catchphrase with a subheading. You know, and I think with anything, like a nation, the idea of a nation, like the idea of a motherland, the idea of anything, when a concept becomes bigger, when a word or catchphrase becomes bigger than what it stands for and the multiplicities of meanings that it stands for, like Patty said, it's too dangerous. It's dangerous because it has this sort of, it is wielding power in a way that's unchecked for me. And I'm a paranoid person of any kind of power holding. So I actually, it's only now in 2020 that I understood how much power like yes and as a catchphrase has. And then, you know, when I started working with corporates, I realized people use yes and as like a marketing tool. They don't care so much about improvisational qualities or essence. They want to bag that corporate, I want to bag that corporate gig. And yes and is so much easier to sell than say, you know, just be good human beings to each other and believe in like humanly things. And they're like, oh, okay, get out. And you're like, yes, and I'm like, oh my God, it's so jazzy. And they're like, yes, we want that. So the catchphrase becomes sort of bigger than, and it's okay to do that, I guess, because you know how we make a lot of money in improv. But then when you get that opportunity, you can stand on that and expand it. I think once one gets lazy or one doesn't think critically because something is handed down and this is how things are supposed to be, then it becomes really big and dangerous because it becomes unwieldy. Like you can't hold it anymore. You don't know why you said it in the first place. And that's always a scary place for anything generally.
I think yes and as a beginning, as a beginner in improvisation, it's a great tool to know only for that moment to just, you know, as you're entering, because as people, it's tough for us to just agree on everything that's given. And that's when we kill our scenes or kill what is given to us. So yes and is a great stepping stone to enter improv. But I think what also is the issue is how whoever's guiding or the teacher is teaching, how they explain it to the students so that it doesn't become the thing, the written thing of improv, because that's, and these kind of discussions are great for that, I think. Because when I started off, yes and helped me enter scenes, organically move into scenes and grow with it. But now at this stage, I agree, yes and is more like a concept. It's about acknowledging and it's not about just be doing that all the time. I also want to add on to what Lakshmi spoke about corporates, because I do a lot of improv workshops with corporates, and definitely yes and is a great hook. But I've also got questions from senior leaders in corporates asking that, you know, if we keep yes anding, how are we going to say no to the person? You know, they'll keep wanting their ideas in. And that's when I bring in the thought to them that yes and is not about just agreeing. It's about acknowledging that, yes, I hear you. Because typically as people, we are the butts, you know, how things cannot work is a very easy thing for us to say, especially in the corporate world. So yes, that is a great tool, again, to just acknowledge that I hear, but let's build on it. Let's figure out a constructive communication around it. That's, it could help with that, to build on whatever you've offered me and then see whether it's workable or not. So yeah, those are my bits on yes, and.
I don't really have anything different to add there, other than the fact that I was quite lucky that in my improv education, it always, yes and always came with provisos and you know, context. And when in my own teaching, when I started that, one of the ways I like to put it was, it you cannot take it literally, because there are always going to be situations in improv where something does not apply. And rather, it's the spirit of yes and that you need to understand. It's not the rote phrase, it's the spirit of the thing. And I think that that's really what everyone else has been saying as well, you know.
Can I ask a slightly different question, Carly? This is something that I've always wondered. As a jazz musician, is there an equivalent of yes and in jazz improvisation? Because one thing that I think about in sort of like Sorry, I'm not going to ask a second question on top of the first question. Is there an equivalent, like, concept or phrase in jazz improvisation?
The very fast answer is no. But the trouble is, so I got interested in jazz in my teens. I was listening to all the great, like, 40s, 50s, 60s stuff, Thelonious Monk, Coltrane, Ornette Coleman, like all of these guys that were true improvisers. And then when I went to music college, I was just really disheartened because everything that people were talking about was theory. It was all music theory and harmonic theory, not even theory of melody or anything like that. It was all about harmony. And it took me about 10 years after going through music college and then discovering improv theater where I was just like, it wasn't me, it was them. They weren't talking about the most important thing, which is interaction and being present with your fellow improvisers. So it's a big gap in jazz music now. And one of the reasons why I think it just doesn't have the same kind of weight that it used to have, for me anyway. I mean, even the technically brilliant musicians, they're not communicating in the same way, generally speaking, because I don't think they have a theory of aesthetics. And the great thing that we have in improv theater is it's all aesthetics because our instrument is ourselves. And, you know, we can refine that, but you know, that the whole point is to be as present as possible. That's what's being taught to us. So I really do feel that, you know, jazz musicians are missing out if something like this is not included, if some kind of yes and type idea isn't introduced to them. And I will just add one more thing, because I think this is particularly interesting. I've done these workshops, Music for Humans, they're called, and basically I introduce beginner musicians to music making using improv theater language and techniques. But we've also had some real serious hard-hitting pros come along as well, and they've actually been blown away by the stuff as well. This is them playing with complete amateurs and getting a whole other experience out of the interaction with them. So, you know, to go back to the quick form, know that there isn't something like this in jazz. It's kind of a big thing that's missing.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Always wondered.
Thank you. Great question.
We're coming towards the end, so I'm going to fit in one, hopefully two, questions. So a question here from Kevin Yap.
Yes, sir. I was just going to say, we did start 10 minutes late, so I'm hoping that we can Kevin Yap's and Tim Redmond's question in.
Yes.
Panelist, if that delay of time is an issue for you, please send us a note. Otherwise, go Jim.
Excellent. Okay, so question from Kevin Yap. From the perspective of an improv teacher, what is the pickup rate of improvisation as an art form within your country? Because Kevin says in his question that a lot of Asian countries being freely expressive is not generally normalized as a thing. So how willing are people to leap in to improvising?
I'm going to jump in here very quickly and just say the same thing as Patty did earlier. This is not really a question for me, but Jun Imai is the guy to check out, the In the Moment program here in Japan, who's doing a lot of work to spread improv here. So that's my 2 cents, half a cent, I don't know.
I'm just going to add in a quote that I read from Wu Xiaoxian about theater sports in Taiwan, that you had to teach the audiences not to be so polite.
Yeah. And I wanted to have better understanding about the question. Can Jim explain the question
Absolutely.
Again?
So Kevin's question is that in a lot of Asian countries, he says that being freely expressive and I'm guessing big and silly and being putting yourself out there creatively, it's not generally normalized. So he's saying, what's your experience of people signing up to improv classes or picking up the principles of improvisation in classes? Like, does it take a while? Is it fairly straight? Does it happen right away? Kevin, please correct me in the chat if I'm misrepresenting your question.
Okay, I think for us in Taiwan, I think it's about what people use to learning things. When we are like at school, in Taiwan, students always sit in the classroom, listen to the teacher. That's the what we will do for the most of the time. So when they come to the improv workshop, they turning them into a right learning mode. I think it's important for us. So I think what we work on a lot in our group for teaching improv is we really trying to be very gentle and very slow at the beginning to break the ice. And we're breaking the ice not only for the individual, but also between people in the group. So our concept is we make every individual improv workshop as a team. So we have a team building process at the beginning of the workshop, if that's especially for a longer run of a workshop, maybe a six class or workshop or eight class workshop, we make the class as a team. So we team building at the beginning of the workshop. I think that really helpful for them to no, we are here to support each other, and you are very welcome to take risk in this circle, because that's why we are here for. And I think that's one thing we really, in our group, we see that's very important thing for every improv class.
Okay. Thank you so much. Aren't you?
Yeah. So here, improv, I think in my side, what I've seen, it's not something that everybody is keen to take on. So it's not like a theater class where one knows in theater, you're going to learn a certain things and you know what's you're entering for, what you're going to get out of it. So it's kind of vague in people's heads somewhere, I think. And also the fact that you have to be vulnerable in improv. Sometimes you make a fool of yourself as well, right? You could be doing things which you would have done when you were 3, 4, or 5 years old. Are you really ready to do that? So I think somewhere I do see that as a hindrance where people don't want to show that part of them. So I would say it's either people who watched improv somewhere and felt it's interesting to look at it, or it could be people who got one dose of it and suddenly realized that it's not just fun, it's therapeutic too. So I am evolving as a person and it's helping me so much individually that, you know, performance could be a next stage, but I could just try it for myself. So that, those are the kind of people I would say largely who either want to have a lot of fun or find it therapeutic for themselves, initially get into it, and then gradually, of course, move on to the next level. Having said all of this, I've also seen we don't have too many women around. Like in my group, we are just two women, and the rest are, we are about 10 people, and the rest are all men. So we may have women coming in for workshops, but they may not stay on to become performers or stay on to do many shows. So again, is it because of the fact that you don't want to expose yourself? Because it's a lot of exposure. We all know how a lot of things which are top of mind for us, are a lot of things which we aren't ready for, we suddenly do it on stage in front of people. I don't know if that's the reason of that restriction, or is it just because of time and the importance that you give in your scale of things at work. But yes, definitely there are more men there. So demographically, I would say, at least my side, I've seen fewer women taking it on a longer journey. So that's what it is here, yeah.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. And just before you answer, Lakshmi, I've got a message from Kevin here. He wants to clarify that he's using his observations based off on his experience as a Chinese Malaysian in Malaysia, just to, that's where that's coming from. Lakshmi, please.
Yeah, I think because I have been always really loud, I think I've attracted very loud people. I've been very, and I've been loud in both my gaps and my convictions. So for example, I think that way, again, like Anshu was saying, that is the truth of Indian improv, like the ratio of women, and even age-wise, if one were to look, like it's usually people in their 30s, maximum early 40s, and then there are a lot of younger folks. So that is the, I guess, people it's speaking to. However, I am part of probably India's one of the only active all women groups, because I've also been sort of careful just as a person with whom I perform, etc. As a teacher, during 2020 in the online improv time, I started to be able to teach a Western audience, like in the US and in the UK. And what I observed was, no matter the cultural reality, and this is not to say that there are no differences, like in India, at least India, Bangalore, my setting definitely has very codified relational hierarchies. Those are real, and not that everybody is following them, but they are codified and they exist. But even in, I think, Western spaces of teaching, I think there's a definite necessity for creating a space to be vulnerable. You know, like maybe people are okay to be expressive, but always like their quick jump to express is not necessarily the level of authenticity and vulnerability we might be able to excavate and help others experience in an improv class or show. So I think across culture, there are veils of different cultural expectations, but no matter what, people do require some level of safety and holding and assurances and expectation setting to say, hey, you're safe here. And nothing about all the masks you're wearing outside is going to crumble because you take 8 classes in improv, or unless you want it to crumble. You know, and that is the invitation. For me, that's really the invitation into improv. Like, do you really need this mask? Do you really think you would like stop being yourself if you were to let go of some of that baggage and pressure and adulting or whatever? So having said that, it is mostly urban folk in my teaching. It's mostly people who are young. It's mostly people who can afford to spend money. And that's a vacuum which is real. As a country which has a very earning 20-year-olds, they are looking for new things to do. So a lot of people who turn up in these workshops are people with some disposable cash. And that's not a lot of people in India, as you know, from our gross domestic product GDP. So yeah.
Fantastic. Thank you. I'm going to try and squeeze in one last question here from Timmy Redmond. I'm going to make a terrible segue. There was an early draft of Patty's book where, just to build off what you were saying there about vulnerability, Lakshmi, is that Patty said in the original draft of one of the chapters that people are more comfortable sort of like dancing at midnight with a vampire and being sort of like big and silly than holding hands with another character and being vulnerable. And to connect to vampires, my friend Michael Hing is a comedian. He used to talk about show ideas that wouldn't die as Draculas. He would say, like, we'll do a show where you bring out your Draculas, of like the shows that you can never quite make happen, or the sketch ideas that never quite work, but they still hang around and they just refuse to die and they live with you. So Tim Redmond has asked, what's your show idea that you haven't been able to make yet, but is with you all the time? I'll go first. A time looping escape room. That's it. Anybody else have a show that they keep wanting to put on but haven't quite been able to? Patty.
I'm haunted by Wim Wenders' films, Wings of Desire, and I keep wanting to do an improv show that's dealing with morality and choices and angels, and the angels that maybe walk with us, the angels and demons, and do they influence those choices? And I visualize it. I see the shadows. I see the movement. I know the content, but I still haven't found the key to land it and start working on it. And maybe the key is stop thinking about it, get into a room, play. But that's my vampire.
Lakshmi?
I think mine is located in the intersection of like playback theater and improvisation. I'm really, my most expertise is in creating a space for real life stories, because I've been doing improv like a little much lesser than I've been doing playback theater, and that's sort of the skills that are for me more trained. So I keep imagining performance site specific, so not in a show, not in people's houses, public parks, and all of this is quite difficult in India because you don't get bureaucratic approvals for this. So these have to be sort of like, do the show, run if the cops are coming sort of shows. And with a musician, and we have like wonderful musician in our playback company, and maybe a couple of playback actors, and then start with playing a game, and then just progressively start into getting into a conversation, and then do like reflect their art back in a way that, you know, it says something about the social position and the time we are in right now. And the big, big, big dream is to create small ripples towards the next general election, because we are doomed if the same government comes another year, according to me. But that's a really big dream. That is a show.
Excellent. It was quite spooky that your internet started to freeze for just a second there as you started talking about the election. So this panel is haunted. I'm sure Kali or Xiaxian, is there anything that you'd like to add?
Please go ahead.
So something that's always made me quite interested in, but I haven't had the courage to try it, is Augusto Boal's Invisible Theater, which is a lot of improv because you just take real situations and pick up on real people, any cause, and your actors just come in, play out a situation and just move out. Nobody gets to know it's actually improv and acting that happened, because you just wanted to understand people's reaction to that social cause. I haven't had the guts to do it yet, but I wish one day I will be able to.
Me too, Carly.
So I tend to be quite a conceptual person, so I'm kind of like haunted by all of these things that I've thought about that haven't been able to get together. Loads of musical projects and projects combining music and improv theatre, but the improv theatre one that I'm being haunted by still is around world building, like the kind of detailed stuff that we find a lot in fantasy worlds or a lot of the great cartoons that are being made these days. But the idea of an improv show where the actors play actors trained in the history of a fictional culture, and then the actor, like, you get some information from the audience about what this country is like or this area is like, and then you can show the history of the theater of this country through the different ages, changing it and building it as you see fit. So I really like that idea, just because I love fantasy world building and things that are like, a lot of improv happens, like the assumptions that are going on are based on real, you know, the reality that we inhabit now. And I very much like getting out of this reality when I can. that's one of my things that I would very much like to realize at some point.
Thank you so much. Xiao Xian?
Yeah,
a show that you've got.
There are a lot of shows that I still wanted to make that happen in Taiwan, and one format is—it's probably be surprised for you guys—is I'm very interested in doing improvised Shakespeare here in Taiwan. And I believe in maybe probably all your countries, you have already done that. but because Shakespeare is not in our culture, and it's in certain kind of time and using certain kind of language. And I have seen very good improvised Shakespeare in other countries, and I'm really interested to make that happen in Taiwan. And another reason is because in the theater world of Taiwan, Shakespeare it's huge. People will think the quality theater when it comes to some people who is who studying theater, and also for people who issue the government grant to theater production. So for us as a improvisation theater company, a lot of time it's difficult for us to get a government grant, because I think they see us always like just making comedy. So I'm just very curious if one day we make an improvised Shakespeare, if they will give us grant. So that's one thing I really wanted to do. And another project I might be interested in is to do a Taiwanese speaking improv shows, because in Taiwan we speak in Mandarin, and also Taiwanese is a important language for Taiwan throughout the history, but it's dying. So I wish one day our improviser, we can practice our Taiwanese good enough to do a full Taiwanese speaking show.
Okay. That would be fantastic. I have got a siren going off in the background, which is our alert that it's the end of the panel. We're going to finish there. Thank you all so much for your time, for your thoughts. Thank you to everyone who came in. Audience, would you please give it up for Anshu, for Carly, for Lakshmi, and for Xia Xian, for my ongoing co-host, Patty Stiles. There will be one more Speak Freely happening in just under a month on the 30th of October, nearly Halloween, very spooky. We'll have a completely spooky themed, I haven't talked to Patty about this. All ghosts.
All ghosts.
No, I think next time we're visiting the Americas, is that right, Patty?
That's right. We do have Joe Bill confirmed to be on the panel, as well as Elise Rodriguez and Danielle Orencia from Colombia. And we will have one or two more guests coming on.
Fun fact, Carly, Daniel, and I all attended the same workshop with Keith Johnson.
I was just thinking that, yeah.
Coming up to 8 years ago. Oh God, it was 8 years ago. Anyway, thank you all so much for your time. Thank you for the fantastic questions, audience, and we look forward to seeing you at the next one. Have a lovely weekend and goodbye.
Bye.